I'm Nancy Cavey, National ERISA and Individual Disability Attorney. Welcome to Winning Isn't Easy. Before we get started, I have got to give you a legal disclaimer. This podcast is not legal advice. The Florida Bar Association says I have to say it, so I've said it. In this episode, I'm going to be talking about how disability insurance carriers use the mental nervous policy limitation to their advantage and what you can do about it. The myths that disability insurance policy holders believe about mental nervous and substance abuse policy limitations and the truth. The story of how one court upheld Unum's claim denial in a mold toxicity case under the mental nervous policy limitations. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll begin. Stay tuned.
Have you been robbed of your peace of mind from your disability insurance carrier? You owe it to yourself to get a copy of Robbed of Your Peace of Mind, which provides you with everything you need to know about the long-term disability claim process. Request your free copy of the book at kvlaw.com today.
Ready to start? How disability insurance carriers use the mental nervous policy limitation to their advantage and what you can do about it. Two of the most common provisions in the disability insurance policy that will limit how long a claim will be paid for are the mental nervous disorder and substance abuse clauses. Now, these can be traps for the unwary disabled, including medical professionals. Many times, disability carriers will attempt to label a claim as a mental nervous claim as opposed to a physical claim, or they'll attempt to limit benefits based on the substance abuse provisions in a policy. So let's talk about how insurance companies weaponize these policy provisions. There is no uniform mental nervous disability policy limitation clause, so it's crucial that you get out your disability policy before you stop working and apply for your benefits and read the policy from beginning to end. But in particular, read this provision closely. The provision may say that benefits are limited to just 2 years for any disability caused or contributed to because of a psychological condition. I call this the Monty Python wafer thin clause of mental nervous disability. So let's say, for example, you have undergone back surgery because of a herniated disc. You've become depressed because of your continued pain. If your disability policy is broadly written and you have this broadly written mental nervous clause, the carrier very well may deny your benefits after 2 years based on their claim that your disability is contributed to by your pain that in turn causes depression. I know that's strange, but the argument is if that depression contributes just so slightly to your overall disability, benefits are limited to just 2 years. Now, I think you need to know that in advance so that you can combat the disability carrier's mental nervous policy limitation game before your benefits are cut off. That's one provision that will truly rob you of your peace of mind. But what you also need to know is the disability policy may have another clause called the substance abuse clause. Now, that also is a tool that disability carriers will use to limit your disability benefits to just 2 years. Carriers will either wrap up a substance abuse policy limitation into the mental nervous disorder limitation, or they might have a separate substance abuse provision. So let's talk about how carriers weaponize these policy provisions and will deny claims for benefits. As I've said, many disability policies have mental nervous policy limitations. There's no uniform mental nervous disability policy limitation, and there is no uniform substance abuse limitation. So as I have said, it's really crucial that you get that disability policy out before you stop working and read it so you understand what limits there are in terms of your benefits and how you might be able to overcome that. So one of the first issues that we have in a case is substance abuse considered a psychological condition? Well, it might be if the policy incorporates into its definition of psychiatric conditions, the DSM-4. Now, the DSM is a manual that has been developed and used by the American Psychological Association to diagnose mental conditions. And it's pretty broadly written. The disability carrier might invoke that mental nervous limitation if your disability is psychiatric in nature. And the DSM can define substance abuse disorder, including alcohol abuse and addiction, as a psychiatric issue, as is the manifestation of an addiction caused by a physical issue. So you've had that back surgery, you've become addicted to medication, and the carrier is saying, okay, look, we are going to apply the mental nervous policy limitation because your addiction is included in the definition of psychiatric conditions of the DSM. So you need to understand that in advance so that you can potentially combat a disability carrier's misuse of the mental nervous policy limitation. Now, I have to tell you, if that policy limitation is in there, specifically citing to the DSM, it's going to be problematic. And that's where I think you need the assistance of an experienced ERISA disability attorney to address how your individual case may be overcome or how you may just be limited to those 2 years of benefits based on your personal circumstance. Now, the disability policy may also have this substance abuse policy rider, and that is either seen in combination with a specific psychiatric mental nervous limitation and condition that specifically has mention of the DSM, or you may see a very broad mental nervous policy limitation with no specific referral to the DSM, but you'll see a specific substance abuse policy limitation. Now, if your occupation involves burnout, stress, or you have access to addictive medication, I think that that's a concern. If you have an individual disability policy, you might want to add a substance abuse policy rider that will limit the impact of substance abuse issues in your case. And that's particularly true if you're an anesthesiologist, pain management provider, an emergency room physician, a plastic surgeon, and even lawyers or stockbrokers, because these occupations do involve not only stress, but access to addictive medications and substances. This can be a minefield for policyholders. So if you're having psychological issues or substance abuse issues, I think you should be consulting, as I said, with an experienced ERISA disability attorney to know how your policy reads, what the pitfalls are, and potentially any limitations on your coverage. In the next segment, I'm going to do some myth busting, so stay tuned. Welcome back. Let's talk about the myths that disability insurance policyholders believe about how to continue the payment of their benefits after the carrier denies their claim based on mental nervous limitations when they also have a disabling physical condition. My job is to be a myth buster and address the games the disability carriers play to deny or delay the payment of your benefits. And this is where games are definitely played. Now, disability insurance benefits can be paid for both physical conditions, psychiatric conditions, and a combination of physical and psychiatric conditions. However, many disability policy holders believe the myth that they're entitled to continuing benefits after the payment of 2 years of mental nervous benefits if their disability claim is based on both a physical and a psychiatric disability. Why is this a myth? Well, disability carriers want to limit the payment of benefits to the shortest possible period of time. It's not uncommon for disability carriers to limit the payment of psychiatric claims to 12 or 24 months based on the policy terms. But what happens when the claim is based on both a psychological and a psychiatric condition? The answer, and part of the myth problem here, is it's going to depend on the language in your policy. What is the language in the mental nervous condition clause? Now, if the language says that benefits are limited to just 12 or 24 months when the psychiatric condition causes or contributes to the disability, it rarely matters. In fact, I don't think it matters at all if the physical condition is the basis of the disability. it's that contributes to language that's problematic. So even if your psychological condition contributes 1%, the way that that policy is written, the other 99% of back pain just doesn't count. What does a policyholder have to prove to establish physical disability when the symptoms are psychiatric in nature and you don't have that language that contributes to language? So I think that's an important issue for you to understand because, again, this all comes back to the specific policy language. Let's consider the case of Miller versus Hartford Life. Miller worked as a billing specialist and filed a disability insurance claim based on depression and nonspecific psychosis. Hartford approved her claim based on mental illness, and there was no support in the medical records for any physical impairment that was the cause of her disability. Under the terms of the disability plan, benefits were only payable for 12 months for claims based on mental nervous conditions. Miller was paid for 12 months and then her claim was denied. She appealed and she claimed that for the first time, her mental illness was secondary to a physical impairment. Hartford reviewed her medical records and agreed she had a disabling physical condition based on the restrictions and limitations identified by one reviewing provider who concluded that she didn't have the capacity to do sedentary work. So that's great. Hartford reversed the claim, but reminded Miller that she had to submit continuing evidence of a disabling physical condition to continue to receive benefits. 1 year later, Hartford learned that Miller was receiving only treatment from a psychiatrist. That was a problem, and she had been given a warning that she ignored. Hartford requested that she submit information about her claimed physical disability, and once again reminded her that she had received all the mental illness benefits that were payable under the terms of the policy. Unfortunately, her treating psychiatrist opined that she had little to no ability to work because of her mental illness, and she submitted no evidence of physical disability. Hartford scheduled her for an independent medical evaluation, and she was diagnosed with a major depressive disorder with psychosis, which was secondary or exacerbated by a thyroid condition. Now, the examining physician opined that there was no physical impairment that would preclude her from engaging in full-time work, but noted there was a possible link between her thyroid disorder and her psychotic episodes. Hartford denied her claim, and she appealed on the basis that her antipsychotic medication caused her to suffer from side effects such as blurred vision, tremors, muscle stiffness, and fatigue, which prevented her from working. The peer review doctor once again communicated with a treating psychiatrist, and it was concluded that the side effects of the medication didn't preclude her from working. And at no time ever did she provide Hartford with any evidence connecting her mental illness to the thyroid disorder. Now, clearly, that was a problem. What do you think the court did? Well, the court did what the court had to do. The court upheld the claim denial based on the lack of connection between the thyroid disorder and the psychiatric condition. The failure to submit this medical link was the key to the court saying, hey, this is a valid denial. Because why? The policyholder has the burden of submitting the necessary medical proof, not the disability insurance company. This case, I think, is just one example of why you need an experienced ERISA disability attorney to help you get the benefits you deserve. Don't lose the chance to win an appeal by neglecting to provide the necessary medical evidence of the physical cause of your mental or emotional conditions. You've got to connect the two. The truth is that the terms of the mental nervous policy limitation will determine if you have the ability to claim ongoing disability benefits. Remember, if there's that Monty Python contribution language, that will destroy your ability to get the benefits. That 1% will overcome the 99% of the physical causes for the disability. If the denial is just basically caused language, in other words, the policy says benefits are limited to just 2 years based on a disability caused by mental issues, you're going to need to overcome that with overwhelming proof that the physical problems are the cause of the ongoing disability and not a psychiatric condition. And clearly, you're going to need the help of an experienced ERISA disability attorney to develop that medical and vocational evidence. In the next segment, I'm going to tell you the story of how one court upheld Unum's claim denial in a mold toxicity case under the mental nervous policy limitations. Stay tuned.
Are you a professional with questions about your individual disability policy? You need the Disability Insurance Claim Survival Guide for Professionals. This book gives you a comprehensive understanding of your disability policy with tips and to-dos regarding your disability application that will assist you in submitting a winning disability application. This is one you won't want to miss. For the next 24 hours, we are giving away free copies of the Disability Insurance Claim Survival Guide for Professionals. Order yours today at disabilityclaimsforprofessionals.com.
Welcome back to Winning Isn't Easy. Sometimes court cases read like mystery stories. Sometimes they read like fairy tales, and other times they read like horror stories. I'm going to tell you the horror story of how one court upheld Unum's claim denial in a mold toxicity claim under the mental nervous policy limitations. Now, one of the many weapons that disability carriers like Unum will use to justify a claims denial after the payment of 2 years of long-term disability benefits is the mental nervous policy limitation. It's a weapon that Unum uses in cases where the policyholder has both a physical and a mental basis for their continuing disability. So let's learn the tricks and trade techniques of Unum and how they use this mental nervous condition to deny benefits to a policyholder with mold toxicity. Now, I read all of the new ERISA disability cases every week because I think it's a great way to learn the games the disability carriers play and how the courts react. And this case is not one that has a happy ending at all. Let me tell you the story of Ms. McCook. She worked as an account manager for Ubisoft, selling video games to retailers. She became disabled as a result of mold toxicity. So she had environmental sensitivity, cognitive impairment, and depression and anxiety. Her physicians diagnosed her with an unspecified neurocognitive disorder and an adjustment disorder with mixed anxiety and a depressed mood. Her Unum disability policy provided that after the payment of benefits for 24 months, her benefits would be limited, and that was basically going to be all that she would be entitled to. One of the most important provisions in a policy is the definition of mental disorder. And we've alluded to that in other episodes. In this particular case, the definition of mental disorder was a psychiatric or psychological condition classified in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Health Disorders published by the American Psychiatric Association, most current as of the start of the disability. Such disorders include, but are not limited to, psychotic, emotional, or behavioral disorders. The policy went on to provide that Unum couldn't apply the mental disorder limitation if dementia was the result of a stroke, trauma, viral infection, Alzheimer's disease, or other conditions not listed, which are not usually treated by mental health providers or qualified providers using psychotherapy, psychotropic drugs, or other similar methods of treatment. So how did this play out in her case? In this case, Unum approved Ms. McCook's long-term disability benefits, but only for a psychiatric impairment. McCook's treating physicians contacted Unum and said, look, reconsider this. We think environmentally susceptible patients for years have been misdiagnosed and misclassified as psychologically impaired by doctors who just don't specialize in chemical or environmental sensitivity issues. Unfortunately, her doctors did not sway Unum's liar-for-hire peer-reviewed providers, and Unum kept on telling McCook that her claim would be denied after 2 years under the mental nervous policy limitations. And in that first 2 years, she continued to receive treatment, including psychotherapy. Now, what happened just prior to the termination of benefits? She supplied Unum with attending physician statements in which she was diagnosed with toxic encephalopathy, autonomic nervous system dysfunction, and chemical sensitivity based on her failure on a Romberg test and the results of a triple camera SPECT brain scan. Now that sounds objective, doesn't it? Her physicians opined that her anxiety and depression stemmed from the neurotoxicity. Unum's physician dismissed all of the laboratory testing. They opined that there was no physical evidence to justify a physiological impairment and rejected the results of the brain scan. Of course, her claim was denied, and ultimately she ends up in federal court. In the case of McCook versus Unum Life, the Louisiana court, using what's called a de novo standard of review, found that she had not met her burden of establishing that she had a physiological or a physical condition. And under the de novo standard of review, the judge can substitute their judgment for that of the disability insurance carrier. Now, the judge found that the evidence provided by Ms. McCook lacked support from the scientific community, as the SPECT test was not a reliable method of examining for toxic exposure. The court acknowledged her argument that there was no better evidence that existed other than the SPECT test to confirm her physiological condition. But the fact that the proper testing doesn't exist doesn't mean that carriers like Unum have to acknowledge or accept the best testing method available when that method is not scientifically reliable. So in other words, the basis for the diagnosis has to be based on objective testing, which is scientifically reliable and valid. And the federal law is very clear that that is the standard for accepting these kinds of testing. And if you don't have reliable testing results, viable testing results, those that are recognized in the scientific community, it doesn't matter what the testing results are. The court has the ability to reject that evidence, as does the disability carrier. So what are the lessons learned here? The first is that environmental toxicity cases are really tough to win. The second is that a lack of scientifically accepted supporting diagnostic testing can make it difficult to convince even the most sympathetic judge to reverse a denial. And it's clear that carriers will misuse the mental nervous policy limitations to their advantage and to deny claims. Well, that's it for this episode. If you like this podcast, consider liking our page, leaving a review, or sharing it with your friends and family. Remember, our podcast comes out weekly, so tune in next week for another episode of Winning Isn't Easy.